This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Something like 1.5 million individuals now hold top secret clearance. Many of them are working for private contractors. So what we're seeing is the burgeoning business of intelligence being contracted out to corporations instead of government agencies that are supposedly accountable to the public at large. They have a lot of their business being done by independent military contractors. And I know your listeners are familiar with really the creep of the militarization, drones, other technology that it's making its way into civilian life. And we're hearing about the Army spying on individuals the way they did back in the 60s. So I think one of the concerns is that big business now includes intelligence. And so the spying apparatus seems quite well cemented in our daily life.
Heidi, hang on. Hold that thought. We'll try to get back to you in just a moment. Right now, we're out of time for this. It's been AIR Cascadia for Monday, June 10th, 2013. Joe Clement engineered the show today. Thanks, Joe. Kathleen Stevenson is the KBOOAM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Andre. Get the facts. Know your rights. Take a stand. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or WilkinCPAS.com.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing and Full Circle Resale, hosting its 29th annual anniversary celebration, June 14th through June 23rd. Specializing in 100% natural fiber clothing, Gazelle and Full Circle Resale are both located at the corner of Northeast 41st and Fremont and at GazelleNaturalFiberClothing.com or FullCircleResalePortland.com.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Portland appearance of David K. Johnston, author of the book, The Rise of Monopolists, Why the Few Get Rich While Your Paycheck Shrinks. The book explains how the already very rich have for three decades quietly earned huge profits with help from politicians. David K. Johnston will be speaking at the First Unitarian Church on Friday, June 14th at 7 p.m. about the devastating economic stories unfolding in the public record that major media do not cover. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning and welcome to Luckus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Could it be that the answers to some of our most challenging global problems, like climate change, involve neither advanced technologies nor huge amounts of money, but the humble layer of soil beneath our feet? The problem, however, is that we're losing topsoil somewhere between 10 and 40 times faster than we're regenerating it. This morning, we talk with Judith Schwartz, author of Cows Save the Planet and Other Improbable Ways of Restoring Soil to Heal the Earth, about how focusing on soil restoration will allow us to chip away at the seemingly unsurmountable problems we currently face. Judith, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thanks so much, Barbara.
So let's talk about why soil is such an important part of, in, for one thing, helping to mitigate some of the effects of climate change.
Yeah, it's kind of an amazing thing that we never talk about soil. However, when you think about it, all of our key biological, biophysical cycles move through the soil. So by hitting at the soil, and more specifically, restoring it and improving it, then we can begin, as you said, to chip away at these problems. So we can look at climate change. All right, so whenever we talk about climate change, we think of it as a sky thing, like everything that's important is happening up there in the sky. We're emitting all these fossil fuel, burning fossil fuels and emitting greenhouse gases, and that's all happening up there, and that's why we're getting high concentrations of CO2. However, when we really look at where the CO2 comes from, way more CO2 has, over time, has come from soil, from the way that we have acted upon the soil, compared to the burning of fossil fuels. So once you think about that, then that changes the whole equation, because it's not just about stopping what we're putting out there, it's about bringing the carbon back into the soil.
And actually, having carbon in the soil is a very important piece of having soil that can really produce healthy plants. So let's talk a little bit about what's in the soil, because I think people sometimes think of soil as just a bunch of dirt and don't realize how many life forms actually comprise what is soil. And without those life forms, we wouldn't have soil. We would have, I guess, little bits of sand or something like that.
That's right. That's right. Okay, well, I'll just start with the carbon. Okay, what we want in the soil, when you're growing something, what you want is soil rich in organic matter. Organic matter is 58% or so carbon, okay? So when you have carbon in the soil, you have the life in the soil. You also are able to hold water in the ground, okay? That's important. And then you're also able to feed all the microorganisms with the water and all the organic matter, the stuff in it. So you asked about the microorganisms, or like all the little things that we don't really realize are in the soil. It's like almost countless. There, in one teaspoon of healthy soil, there's something like 6 billion life forms. There are species that scientists are only beginning to understand. I mean, you know, this is such a new area. I'm trying to remember that it was something like, you know, that one soil microbiologist said that perhaps we've identified maybe 10% of the life forms in there. I mean, it's remarkable. Scientists are beginning to talk about soil less as a thing than as a community.
Well, one of the things that you mentioned in your book is how our agricultural practices that have become dominant in the last 60, 70 years actually disregard the core of what makes soil healthy, which are these life forms, and is trying to supplant organic life forms with chemical life forms, or chemical lack of life forms. So let's talk a bit about some of the agricultural practices that are being so detrimental to having healthy soil.
Okay, well, one that comes up a lot, and I know we'll get to the additives, but one just very basic thing is that in conventional agriculture, often when the crops are harvested, the soil is left bare. And the way one of the soil, like soil restoration people that I talk to, he says that tells the microbiology in the soil, like, okay, season's over, we're not feeding you anymore till next spring. So the soil microorganisms have a hard time surviving. And then when that happens, then the soil does become lifeless. And then when the soil becomes lifeless, then it's more prone to erosion. It doesn't hold water. It dries out, all those things. It's a negative cycle.
I just want to interject for a second, because you say an interesting thing about how when the fields are allowed to lie fallow, we're no longer feeding the microbial organisms that are in the soil. So it sort of sounds like there's a symbiotic relationship between the life forms in the soil and the plants that we're trying to grow above the surface of the soil.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You can't really grow plants in the absence of that life. Okay, the way it works is it's a whole biological system. And the way that our agricultural technology has developed and our way of thinking about agriculture is more of a chemical model. And they're very, very different. And once you shift to the biological model, then you start to understand all these processes that are part of it. For example, it's the life in the soil that breaks down the minerals in the soil. I mean, there's all this stuff in the soil. I mentioned that there are all these living organisms. There are also minerals. And when they're inactivated or the balance is thrown off in the soil between the fungi and the microbes and the bacteria, et cetera, then you don't get these life forms breaking down the minerals so that they are available to the plants. That's really a key part of the equation, because we know that we need certain minerals, et cetera, in our foods. Okay, we don't really have in the public, we don't have a great understanding of this. It's kind of like, oh, yes, 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 we're supposed to have this, this, and this, and the cereal box says that this should contain X, Y, and Z. But the way that those minerals get into the food is through these processes. So when, let's say there, I guess we'll go straight to Roundup. Let's like we'll hit right on Monsanto.
Good, actually, that's a very hot topic this week in Oregon. So yes. I'd like to talk about Monsanto, and then we'll move into GMO stuff as well.
Okay. So if a conventional farmer is using Roundup. Roundup is an herbicide, and that's to stop weeds. What happens is that Roundup, that chemical, first of all, the way it works is it basically weakens the plant. So, but even if plants can survive on it, it's still having a huge, even if plants are designed to withstand that.
The Roundup Ready varieties of crops you're talking about.
Right. Thank you for clarifying. But it's still having that effect in the soil. One thing that it's doing is it is throwing off the balance of the microbial life. And that leaves the plants more susceptible to certain pathogens, okay? So when you throw off the balance in that community, then there are certain vulnerabilities that happen. Another thing is that the way that glyphosate works, glyphosate is the generic term, that's the chemical term for Roundup. Roundup is the proprietary name for that particular product that's licensed it's a trademark of Monsanto. So the way that it works is that it chelates minerals and trace minerals. What that means is it binds them. So because it's binding those minerals, they are no longer available to the plants. So even if those minerals are in the soil, and sometimes when you have land that's been grown on continuously without it being replenished by more soil organic matter, and sometimes it's only kind of fed with like the basic additives, mineral additives. So if that's the case, there may be these minerals in the soil, but the plants can't bring them up into the crop because they're locked up. They've been chelated. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, pretty much. So basically what's happening is that all the nutrients that are in the soil get locked in the soil. The plants can't take them up. And that it seems that the soil itself becomes kind of barren. And what's happening to the microbial life forms in the soil when all these chemicals are being laden on the soil?
Well, they're not very happy. there's the way that people are beginning to understand soil life as we have more and more instruments that can tell us what's actually going on there, in there, on, you know, on such a tiny, tiny, tiny level. It's the soil food web. It's a community of interacting entities. Okay, so one kind of additive would be a fungicide. Well, that kills off fungus, and there are all kinds of fungi that are extremely beneficial. And one kind, I don't know how sciencey you want me to get here, but one kind, it's mycorrhizal fungi, which basically means like they're at the root. It's incredible what these things do, okay? Most plants have them or live in association with mycorrhizal fungi. What they do is they have like long string-like hyphae. So they are constantly exchanging minerals and water, etc., for the liquid carbon, the food that the plant makes and draws down into the roots. So it's this incredibly complex network, and so they're in symbiosis. But if there's a chemical that's put on that's intended to kill a plant fungus, well then those beneficial fungus die out as well. And one thing that we're learning about these particular fungi is that there's a particular substance that, I mean, I think this is so cool that it was like less than 10 years ago or only 15 years ago or so that this was even identified. It's called glomalin, and it's a glycoprotein. It's like a sugar protein, and that's where much of the carbon in soil is stored. So if you don't have this fungus, if you don't have a thriving community in the soil, then you're not going to have this way for plants to network underground and get what they need, nor do you have this particular thing that we're just beginning to learn about, how about the role that it plays in holding carbon in the soil and doing many other things as well that we're, like I said, we're only beginning to understand.
Well, this morning we're talking with Judith Schwartz, who's written a book called Cows Save the Planet and Other Improbable Ways of Restoring Soil to Heal the Earth. And we're talking about basically how restoring soil health around the world will help us basically heal the planet on many different levels. Now, the mycorrhizal fungi that you're talking about, do they play a role also in nitrogen fixing and in getting the nitrogen from the atmosphere into the roots of plants?
I don't know, but what they do is that they basically extend the reach of a plant. Okay, so you have a plant, all right? Think of it. I've just been planting myself, so I'm thinking, okay, this tomato plant that I've just put in the ground. The roots go a certain distance. That means that plant has, I don't know, maybe, you know, a foot in diameter to draw upon what's in the soil. What these mycorrhizal fungi offer is they extend the reach. So let's say that where the tomato is, there isn't enough. I mean, it could be nitrogen. I don't know specifically whether there's a nitrogen fixation component there or the ability to get nitrogen, but I know lots of different substances, they extend the reach, which, I mean, think about it. That greatly expands the plant's capacity to thrive because they don't have to depend on what's, like, right in their little tiny spot in the garden. They can reach out.
Now, with the agricultural practices that a majority of farmers are using around the country and a growing degree around the world that are so reliant on chemical inputs, it seems that they have really exhausted their soil. And I'm in touch with a number of farmers in this region in Oregon who are particularly in the Willamette Valley, where grass seed has been the predominant crop for about 40, 50 years, who are trying to restore their soil. And it's a really big project when you've exhausted it because of so many chemical inputs and other practices that compact it. So I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the methods that you've been exploring that help to return soil tilth, the health of the soil, and create fertile soil where there's just been compacted dead soil or dead inert material for the last 50 years or so.
Okay, yeah, there are a number of them. One of them is just basically focusing on bringing carbon back into the soil. And what a number of farmers and ranchers have done, we'll reflect back to the title, although this is not the only method. One method is using livestock as a tool for large-scale land restoration. And livestock, a lot of people say, well, wait, livestock can't help the soil because they've been ruining land. However, anytime you have animals on the land, they're having an impact on the land, and that could be a negative or a positive impact depending on how they are managed. So this practice of holistic planned grazing brings carbon into the soil by having the livestock, the cattle — it's often cattle, so it's easy to talk about cattle, and of course the title of my book is cows, it has the word cows in it — they act as biological accelerators for all the processes that restore soil health. Okay, so they nibble on the grasses, and that promotes the growth of these grasses. And whenever grass is growing up, it's also growing down. So that's bringing the roots deeper down, which means that as the plant is growing and drawing carbon down, the carbon is going deep into the soil. Their waste adds organic matter. Their trampling presses in the decaying plant matter, which gets the microbiology acting on it in a way that it's able to break it down and produce more soil organic matter. So that's the basic dynamic. I can go into more detail, but since you're asking about other...
Actually, I wanted to stop for a moment and talk about that, because I want to let you know that when I put out an email about this show over this week, I got a couple very inflamed responses from, one from an ecologist in Ashland, Oregon, that I've had on the show a lot, who I have a great deal of respect for. And I guess he put me in touch with a colleague of his at Oregon State University, who has written a paper that's called "Adapting to Climate Change on Western Public Lands, Addressing the Ecological Effects of Domestic Wild and Feral Ungulates." And both of them were very concerned about what they consider this hoax of Alan Savory, who you talk about in the book, mm-hmm. who developed this whole holistic management program. And so I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the arguments that are being made that really counter what Alan Savory has been going around teaching mm-hmm. for the last four decades. So I wanted mm-hmm. to read you a couple comments that I got and see what your response is. Now, this is from Bernard Foy. It was in a Santa Fe newspaper a little while ago, and he's a scientist and conservation activist in New Mexico. And he says, "It would be wonderful indeed if some savant emerged from the shadows with an amazing new fix for the problem of degradation of public lands from overgrazing of livestock. More than four decades ago, Alan Savory claimed to have such a fix, announcing an enticing magical new remedy for seemingly intractable problems. His solution was surprising, even shocking, simple, easily implemented, and seemed to render meaningless all the harsh rhetoric exhibited regularly in public forums. Holistic range management promised such dramatic increases in livestock forage as to permit doubling the size of cattle herds in the American Southwest, with improvement, not degradation, in the health of the land. How could so many of us have missed this brilliant, innovative approach to a centuries-old problem vexing agency personnel, congressmen, local political leaders, activists, ranchers, and journalists? It eventually became clear that holistic range management was all fluff and no substance. Although there was a ring of truth to the slick presentation, stemming particularly from the notion that grazing by wild ungulate herds could be simulated with the right kind of cattle management, those who looked carefully for positive results from short duration or rotational grazing were left unsatisfied. Many reputable researchers have written extensively about the flaws in Savory's logic, the absence of a convincing demonstration, and the unscientific nature of his counterintuitive assertions." He goes on to talk about how one of the big problems with Savory's method is that it's based on a set of conditions that's in Africa, where he's from, and that these conditions, when you are dealing with cattle, raising cattle in much drier climates like the American Southwest, and for that matter, most of the American West, west of the 100th meridian, the regenerative capabilities of the soil are very different. And in fact, they're much more greatly harmed by large herds of cattle than they would be in Africa. And then another concern that was raised by Robert Breschke from Oregon State University is that when you're trying to mimic the way that buffalo ranged on the plains, that doesn't translate to west of the Rocky Mountains where there were no buffalo. So I'm wondering, did you come across arguments against Alan Savory's methods, and did you find any convincing counterpoints to these kind of arguments?
Absolutely, and I know, yes, I have run across this, and I know that his work is very controversial. When I first wrote a profile of Alan Savory for Conservation Magazine, my inbox was exploding with, I don't even know how these people found out that I was writing about him, but word got out. And I have to say, I am not a scientist, I am not a rancher, but I spent a lot of time looking at the articles that they sent me. And then I would do some reality checking, look at it, and looked at what it is exactly that they were comparing. And that's where it fell short, that often they were comparing something, maybe a mob grazing. See, there are so many different variations on these management approaches, but Alan Savory's is very specific. And I have met so many people who do this, who swear by this, who have used this in different kinds of terrain. Okay, there are two things. There's the holistic management and there's the holistic planned grazing. The holistic management part is the decision-making framework. And that's where you would take a very hard look at how much rain do we get here? What are the properties of the soil? What is the culture that we're working within, et cetera, and apply all these, what are my finances, what are my needs, how much livestock can I afford, et cetera. The grazing is when you're actually applying it and moving the livestock in according to that management plan. I've just interviewed many, many, many people, done as much reading as I could, and it really, from what I can see, it stands up.
Well, I'm wondering if it isn't somewhat like methane digesting, which is, I mean, it works very effectively on small scale, but really does not work at confined animal feed operations that are huge. And I've visited some farms where they're using this kind of management technique. I visited Polyface Farm in Southwest Virginia, Joel Salatin's famous farm, mm-hmm. and he does it, but he has only a few hundred head of cattle on a relatively small farm, and it's also
right,
very...
Also, and he's in a very moist environment.
Right. The first place I ever heard of this actually was at Cal Poly in San Luis Obispo, California, where they are experimenting with trying to replicate the way that elk would have grazed on the landscape in that area and the hills just a little bit inland from the Pacific Ocean. And they were moving the cattle around, but they also were doing it with much smaller amounts of cattle. And I think that the concern that Beshka and also Dominic De La Salle down in Ashland raised is that when you're doing this on public lands, and I don't know how much time you spent out here in the West, where like in Oregon, I think like half of the state is public lands that are used for grazing. This is all east of the Cascades. This is not the part of Oregon most people know about. It's very dry and it's part of the Great Basin. And I mean, I've witnessed the incredible erosion and destruction that has happened from 100 years of grazing when I go hiking out in eastern Oregon. And you see these stream beds that are completely eroded and vegetation is totally gone. And I understand why people really raise questions about how can you put more cattle on a landscape and have it not be detrimental when you're doing it on, you know, hundreds and thousands of acres as opposed to doing it on a 2,000-acre ranch.
Okay. Well, okay, in Savory's model, there's an acknowledgement that overgrazing is a tremendous problem. There's also an acknowledgement that undergrazing can be a problem. And that's what often happens in dried environments, is that those biological processes aren't moved forward. So, for example, when we think about biology, the notion of decay is not the sexiest part, but when decay stalls, then you get dead grasses kind of blocking the sunlight on for new grasses. Do you see what I'm saying? So that contributes to this whole kind of drying out scenario. So the management would be absolutely the Savory, Alan Savory, and anyone he works with totally, totally acknowledges that the grazing of livestock can be horribly destructive to land. It's all a matter of how it's done so that the grasses are neither overgrazed nor undergrazed.
I guess the question people raise, though, is would you really want to increase the grazing of livestock on Western lands when there's so much damage being done? And it's not just the cattle. It's also because there's overpopulations of elk herds, because the wolves, the major carnivores, are removed from much of the landscape now of the West. I mean, they're returning to some degree. Another issue that's raised is that when you expand cattle grazing on public lands, it involves putting up lots of fences, which is very harmful to wolves and mountain lions and other predators that we're trying to return. So I'm wondering how you balance all of this.
Okay, well, it's interesting that you mentioned the predators, because that was a huge problem. What Savory observed is because of one of the reasons that there is so much overgrazing is due to the lack of natural predators, because in the wild, you have animals that are grazing happily in a spot, and then, I'll just bring it back to Africa because that's where most of his work was done, then let's say a lion comes along, and then the antelope or giraffe or zebra would bunch up together. That's their defense mechanism, and then flee as a group. And then in doing so, they're trampling and aerating the soil and pressing in seeds, and they're, most importantly, they're off to another bit of land, so that area is not overgrazed. So the predators are a very important part of the equation, but when there are no natural predators, then people need to move the animals. Now, in Africa, they're doing at the demonstration site, it's in Zimbabwe near Victoria Falls, it's called Dimbengombe. It's that's a lot of land that Savory has been working on for a couple of decades now, and it's drastically improved. One of the exciting things that they're doing is that they are integrating wildlife with the livestock. And so I'm not sure, I haven't been there and I haven't studied this, but they're so that all the livestock are coexisting with elephants and lions, etc. I know that when they move the livestock, there is some protection, but I think it's something different from like the actual fencing that we might think of. But so they're definitely working on that. And I think it's pretty exciting to have this coexisting with bringing back some other wild predators.
Well, we've got big issues here in Oregon because the ranchers in eastern Oregon would like to shoot the wolves when they come in contact with their cattle. So, I mean, I think this is another big, rather large story, and one where I, in a way, I thought it was a little bit unfortunate that you called your book Cows Save the Planet, because I think a lot of the other management techniques that you talk about are really very interesting, and also I think perhaps a little bit less controversial, a little bit more proven. And I know people in Oregon that are practicing a lot of the techniques you talk about. So why don't we move on to those? And we are going to have a show in a couple weeks where we'll be talking about some of the issues that are raised by Alan Savory. So get the other side of that. But let's talk about biodiversity, which I think is another thing. You're describing the life forms in the soil, which is perhaps the greatest biodiversity we have on Earth. But how does that help to regenerate biodiversity above the soil?
Okay. Basically, let's say, all right, so we've got our soil community, all right? Let's say that for whatever reason, it could be the chemical inputs or perhaps a monoculture that only feeds certain types of organisms. You know what I mean? I mean, like that they're only planting one crop so that only feeds certain organisms. Anyway, for whatever reason, let's say that you don't have that full balance. Well, that limits the kinds of plants that can grow on that land. Okay? I think I might have turned this into a little bit of a pretzel. Let me just start again. Okay, when you have, let's say you have a piece of land and the balance is no longer of a full complement of the microbial life in the soil, that limits the kinds of plants that can grow on that land. And the kind of plants that you have, if you have a limited range of plants, and that limits the types of smaller animals and amphibians and insects that are able to thrive on that land. And then it goes up the food chain. I guess that's, in a simple way, that's basically what I mean, that it goes up the food chain. However, if you're able to restore the soil biodiversity, then there are more chances that a broader diversity of life will be on the land and flying above it. There is a farmer that I visited in North Dakota, and he basically, his approach has been to farm for biodiversity. And he said that the more that he works on that and feeds the soil so that a wide range of soil life is happy, then the better that his land has produced, the more life forms he sees and hears on his land, and the better off everything is.
Well, actually, I've talked with a number of organic farmers around here who talk about they've transitioned from being chemical commodity farmers, and they talk about the way that it's not just like the biodiversity on the crops, but also that they are working with nature, and so there's a whole lot of different life forms that start to reemerge on their farms. And one really interesting one is watching the swallows. Whenever they're plowing, the swallows come like crazy, and they're going for all the bugs that are released in the soil when they plow. So I think there's another dynamic that happens when you start to farm more holistically, is that you are working with a wider range of nature, and then a lot of the natural life forms and systems actually help you to control pests and other problems that you'd have as a farmer.
Absolutely. There are synergies that go on in nature that we just have no idea about. And that's exactly what this particular farmer, whose name is Gene Govan, what he said is that he doesn't have to worry about weeds because the diversity of his plants keeps everything under control. There's no one weed that comes in and dominates. And also he because he's got a lot of insects, then that also helps the diversity of plants, because like the dung beetle, we spoke at length about the dung beetle. He said, called them his no-till drill, that they bring down seeds into the soil that then sprout up. And anyway, it was really fun to be with him, because going around his farm was a little bit like being on a safari, you know, you know, that we'd see like all the birds and all the butterflies and everything, and just kind of, you know, how rich it all was. And this was someone who had been farming conventionally, and he said that after he stopped the inputs, that it was maybe a couple of years when the wildflowers came back, and then another year after that when the butterflies came back. And at this point, people from the Audubon Society go visit his land because there are more birds there than anywhere else. I mean, the heartbreaking side of the story is that sometimes if he has like cattle grazing from another place, and those cattle were given some chemicals, he can tell, like he'd get like a big die-off of bees or other kinds of insects. So, you know, then he has to go just kind of wait for the natural processes to reassert themselves yet again.
One last thing I want to talk about that's so important as a soil is water. And you talked in the beginning of the show about the importance of carbon storage in the soil. But what's the relationship between having a nice, healthy amount of carbon in the soil and how much water the soil can hold?
Yeah, the carbon is the component that holds the water. Basically, the water cycle follows the carbon cycle, that when you have carbon in the soil, then you can hold water. And a lot of the problems that we see now come from the fact that our soils are not holding water, because when you get a heavy rain, if the soils are dried out and low in carbon and kind of, you know, dusty, then you get floods and erosion. Whereas if you have land that holds water and has plants on it, then they can absorb water and you don't get flooding with the heavy rains. It just soaks in.
So what are the lessons that you've gathered from traveling around, meeting all these farmers, and watching how they are trying to reclaim the soil on their land?
Oh, what are the lessons?
Yes.
Just focus on soil health, and so much else will follow. Absolutely. Oh, one other method that I thought was worth saying, because this group of people in North Dakota are getting much more sophisticated with this, is cottail cover cropping. So, okay, cover crops are good because they keep putting carbon into the soil. You don't have carbon leaking from the soil. You don't have water evaporating from the soil. It holds things. But different plants draw down different nutrients. So by having combinations again, diversity, having combinations of the crop cover crops that are used in the off-season, you're able to address any shortcomings in the soil. And it can get very interesting because that could also stimulate the growth of how much soil you're building. And, yeah, I just thought that was that's an area that's pretty new in how they're developing that. One thing that I'll also mention, because you in your beginning statement you noted how the extent to which we're losing topsoil, but I think it's really important to know for people to know that one can build soil very relatively quickly, because often when we hear about peak soil, you know, the fact that we're losing soil so much, I mean, to the extent that often if a ton of grain is grown, maybe several tons of topsoil will have been lost or eroded. We often hear that it takes 500 years to build an inch of topsoil. But that's only if you're looking at it geologically. There's a quote that I mention in the book, which is by P.A. Yeomans, an Australian, and he said that soil comes from two processes. One is the process of aging. The other is the process of living. So if you're drawing carbon down into the soil and using other techniques, or the other techniques help, you can build soil rather quickly. And I've talked to many people who have done it, and several inches in a year, which is a very far cry from 1 inch every 500 years. So it's really exciting and makes me feel very optimistic, because in a sense that if you can build a lot of topsoil down, which is what they're doing, then that there's that much more carbon that can be stored in the soil. For every inch, you know, that kind of opens up a whole new space for more carbon to be down there, no longer in our atmosphere.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, Judith, and it's good having you on.
Okay, thanks. I'm not at the clock. Are we done?
We are done, yes.
Okay.
Anyway, we've been talking this morning with Judith Schwartz, who's author of Cows Save the Planet, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus, or better still, go to the search bar in the upper right-hand corner of the KBOO webpage and type in today's date and Locus Focus. Next week, we'll talk about the threat of GMO salmon with Julia DeGraw, who's with Food and Water Watch. I'm Barbara Bernstein. My engineer is Joe Clements. We're going to be going out with some music by Joni Mitchell. Thanks for listening.
It's gone. The paved paradise put up a parking lot. They took all the trees, put them in a tree museum, and they charged all the people an arm and a leg just to see. Till it's gone, the paved paradise put up a parking lot.
Particles on the Wall.
An exploration of the effects of nuclear technology on the Pacific Northwest and the world.
Particles on the Wall.
An exhibit of art, literary works, science, and historical memorabilia that describes the human and environmental impact of the Hanford Nuclear Reservation.
Particles on the Wall.
May 3rd through June 14th, second floor gallery in the EcoTrust building.
Particles on the Wall.
Co-sponsored by Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility and KBOO Community Radio.
Particles on the Wall.
Information can be found online at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the page under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Dr. Robert Amajoyi and the Northwest Center for Colorectal Health, LLC, providing screening colonoscopy to help prevent colorectal cancer, as well as minimally invasive management of colorectal disease. Offices in Portland and Milwaukee. Detailed information at 503-216-5380 or nwcch.com. This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or grendelscoffee.com.
The purpose of this program is not to prescribe a treatment to individuals. Listeners should consult their healthcare practitioner before attempting any treatment.